HarperCollins presents The Paris Apartment by Lucy Foley. Read by Chope Dirisu, Sophia Zervudarchi, Charlie Anson, Claire Corbett, Daphne Kumar, and Julia Winwood.
To Al, for everything.
Prologue. Friday. Ben. His fingers hover over the keyboard. Got to get it all down. This is the story that's going to make his name. Ben lights another cigarette. A gitane. Bit of a cliche to smoke them here, but he does actually like the taste. And fine, yeah. Likes the way he looks smoking them too. He's sitting in front of the apartment's long windows, which look onto the central courtyard. Everything out there is steeped in darkness, save for the weak greenish glow thrown by a single lamp. It's a beautiful building, but there's something rotten at its heart. Now he's discovered it, he can smell the stench of it everywhere. He should be clearing out of here soon. He's outstayed his welcome in this place. Jess could hardly have chosen a worse time to decide to come and stay. She barely gave him any notice. And she didn't give much detail on the phone, but clearly something's up. Something's wrong with whatever crappy bar job she's working now. His half-sister has a knack for turning up when she's not wanted. She's like a homing beacon for trouble. It seems to follow her around. She's never been good at just playing the game. Never understood how much easier it makes life if you just give people what they want. Tell them what they want to hear. Admittedly, he did tell her to come and stay whenever you like. But he didn't really mean it. Trust Jess to take him at his word. When was the last time he saw her? Thinking about her always makes him feel guilty. Should he have been there for her more, looked out for her? She's fragile, Jess. Or not fragile exactly, but vulnerable in a way people probably don't see at first. An armadillo. Softness beneath that tough exterior. Anyway, he should call her, give her some directions. When her phone rings out, he leaves a voice note. Jess, so it's number 12, Rue des Amants. Got that? Third floor. His eyes drawn to a flash of movement in the courtyard beneath the windows. Someone's passing through it quickly, almost running. He can only make out a shadowy figure, can't see who it is. But something about the speed seems odd. He's hit with a little animal spike of adrenaline. He remembers he's still recording the voice note, drags his gaze from the window. Just ring the buzzer. I'll be up waiting for you. He stops speaking. Hesitates, listens. A noise. The sound of footsteps out on the landing, approaching the apartment door. The footsteps stop. Someone is there, just outside. He waits for a knock. None comes. Silence, but a weighted silence, like a held breath. Odd. And then another sound. He stands still, ears pricked, listening intently. There it is again. It's metal on metal, the scrape of a key. Then the clunk of it entering the mechanism. He watches the lock turn. Someone is unlocking his door from the outside. Someone who has a key, but no business coming in here uninvited. The handle begins to move downwards. The door begins to open with that familiar, drawn-out groan. He puts his phone down on the kitchen counter, voice note forgotten, waits, and watches dumbly as the door swings forward, as the figure steps into the room. "What are you doing here?" he asks, calm, reasonable, nothing to hide, not afraid, or not yet. "And why?" Then he sees what his intruder holds. Now the fear comes.
3 hours later, Jess.
For Christ's sake, Ben, answer your phone. I'm freezing my tits off out here.
My Eurostar was 2 hours late leaving London. I should have arrived at 10:30, but it's just gone midnight. And it's cold tonight, even colder here in Paris than it was in London. It's only the end of October, but my breath smokes in the air, and my toes are numb in my boots. Crazy to think there was a heatwave only a few weeks ago. I need a proper coat. But there's always been a lot of things I need that I'm never going to get. I've probably called Ben 10 times now, as my Eurostar pulled in, on the half-hour walk here from Gare du Nord. No answer, and he hasn't replied to any of my texts. Thanks for nothing, big bro. He said he'd be here to let me in.
Just ring the buzzer. I'll be up waiting for you.
Well, I'm here. Here being a dimly lit cobblestoned cul-de-sac in what appears to be a seriously posh neighbourhood. The apartment building in front of me closes off this end, standing all on its own. I glance back down the empty street. Beside a parked car about 20 feet away, I think I see the shadows shift. I step to the side to try and get a better look. There's a squint, trying to make out the shape. I could swear there's someone there, crouched behind the car. I jump as a siren blares a few streets away, loud in the silence. Listen as the sound fades away into the night. It's different to the ones at home. Nino, Nino, like a child's impression. But it still makes my heart beat a little faster. I glance back at the shadowy area behind the parked car. Now I can't make out any movement. Can't even see the shape I thought I glimpsed before. Maybe it was just a trick of the light, after all. I look back up at the building. The others on this street are beautiful, but this one knocks spots off them all. It's set back from the road behind a big gate with a high wall on either side, concealing what must be some sort of garden or courtyard. 5 or 6 stories, huge windows, all with wrought iron balconies. A big sprawl of ivy growing all over the front of it, which looks like a creeping dark stain. If I crane my neck, I can see what might be a roof garden on the top, the spiky shapes of the trees and shrubs black cutouts against the night sky. I double-check the address. Number 12, Rue des Armands. I've definitely got it right. I still can't quite believe this swanky apartment building is where Ben's been living. He said a mate helped sort him out with it. Someone he knew from his student days. But then Ben's always managed to fall on his feet. I suppose it only makes sense that he's charmed his way into a place like this. And charm must have done it. I know journalists probably earn more than bartenders, but not by this much. The metal gate in front of me has a brass lion's head knocker, the fat metal ring held between snarling teeth. Along the top of the gate, I notice, is a bristle of anti-climb spikes. And all along the high wall either side of the gate are embedded shards of glass. These security measures feel kind of at odds with the elegance of the building. I lift up the knocker, cold and heavy in my hand. Let it drop. The clang of it bounces off the cobblestones, so much louder than expected in the silence. In fact, it's so quiet and dark here that it's hard to imagine it's part of the same city I've trundled across this evening from Gare du Nord. All the bright lights and crowds, people spilling in and out of restaurants and bars. I think of the area around that huge cathedral lit up on the hill, the Sacré-Cœur, which I passed beneath only 20 minutes ago. Throngs of tourists out taking selfies and dodgy-looking guys in puffer jackets sharking between them, ready to nick a wallet or two. And the streets that I walk through with the neon signs, the blaring music, the all-night food, the crowds spilling out of bars, the queues for clubs. This is a different universe. I look back down the street behind me. Not another person in sight. The only real sound comes from a scurry of dead ivy across the cobblestones. I can hear the roar of traffic at a distance, the honking of car horns. But even that seems muffled, like it wouldn't dare intrude on this elegant, hushed world. I didn't stop to think much, pulling my case across town from the station. I was mainly concentrating on not getting mugged or letting the broken wheel of my suitcase stick and throw me off balance. But now, for the first time, it sinks in. I'm here, in Paris. A different city, a different country. I've made it. I've left my old life behind. A light snaps on in one of the windows up above. I glance up and there's a dark figure standing there, head and shoulders in silhouette. Ben? If it were him, though, he'd wave down at me, surely. I know I must be lit up by the nearby street lamp. But the figure at the window is as still as a statue. I can't make out any features, or even whether they're male or female. But they're watching me. They must be. I suppose I must look pretty shabby and out of place with my broken old suitcase trying to bust open despite the bungee cord wrapped around it. A strange feeling, knowing they can see me but I can't see them properly. I drop my eyes. To the right of the gate, I spot a little panel of buttons for the different apartments with a lens set into it. The big lion's head knocker must just be for show. I step forward and press the one for the third floor, for Ben's place. I wait for his voice to crackle through the intercom. No answer.
Sophie, penthouse. Someone is knocking on the front door to the building. Loud enough for Benoit, my silver whippet, to leap to his feet and let out a volley of barks. Arrête ça! I shout. Stop that! Benoit whimpers, then goes quiet. He looks up at me, confusion in his dark eyes. I can hear the change in my voice as well. Too shrill, too loud. And I can hear my own breathing in the silence that follows. Rough and shallow. No one ever uses the door knocker. Certainly no one familiar with this building. I go to the windows on this side of the apartment, which look down into the courtyard. I can't see onto the street from here, but the front door from the street leads into the courtyard, so if anyone had come in, I would see them there. But no one has entered, and it must have been a few minutes since the knocking. Clearly it's not someone the concierge thinks should be admitted. Fine. Good. I haven't always liked that woman, but I know I can trust her in this at least. In Paris, you can live in the most luxurious apartment, and the scum of the city will still wash up at your door on occasion. The drug addicts, the vagrants, the whores. Pigalle, the red light district, lies just a little way away, clinging to the coattails of Montmartre. Up here in this multi-million-euro fortress, with its views out over the city's rooftops, all the way to the Tour Eiffel, I have always felt comparatively safe. I can ignore the grime beneath the gilt. I am good at turning a blind eye, usually. But tonight is different. I go to check my reflection in the mirror that hangs in the hallway. I pay close attention to what I see in the glass. Not so bad for 50. It is partly due to the fact that I have adopted the French way when it comes to maintaining my form, which essentially means always being hungry. I know that even at this hour, I will be looking immaculate. My lipstick is flawless. I never leave the apartment without it. Chanel, Les Sontueuses, my signature color. A bluish regal color that says, stand back, not come hither. My hair is a shining black bob, cut every 6 weeks by David Mallet at Notre-Dame du Victoire. The shape perfected, any silver painstakingly concealed. Jacques, my husband, made it quite clear once that he abhors women who allow themselves to go grey, even if he hasn't always been here to admire it. I am wearing what I consider my uniform, my armor, silk equipment shirt, exquisitely cut dark slim trousers, a scarf, brightly patterned Hermes silk around my neck, which is excellent for concealing the ravages of time to the delicate skin there. A recent gift from Jacques, with his love of beautiful things, like this apartment, like me, as I was before I had the bad grace to age. Perfect. As ever, as expected. But I feel dirty, sullied by what I have had to do this evening. In the glass, my eyes glitter, the only sign, though my face is a little gaunt, too, if you were to look closely. I am even thinner than usual. Recently, I have not had to watch my diet, to carefully mark each glass of wine or morsel of croissant. I couldn't tell you what I ate for breakfast this morning, whether I remembered to eat at all. Each day my waistband hangs looser. The bones of my sternum protrude more sharply. I undo the knot of my scarf. I can tie a scarf as well as any born and bred Parisian. By it you know me for one of them, those chic, moneyed women with their small dogs and their excellent breeding. I look at the text message I sent to Jacques last night. Bonne nuit, mon amour. Tu vas bien ici? Good night, my love. Everything is fine here. Everything is fine here. I don't know how it has come to this. But I do know that it started with him coming here, moving into the third floor. Benjamin Daniels. He destroyed everything.
Jess. I pull out my phone. Last time I checked, Ben hadn't replied to any of my messages. One on the Eurostar. On my way. And then, at Gare du Nord, do you have an Uber account? Just in case, you know. He suddenly felt generous enough to send a cab to collect me. Seemed worth a shot. There is a new message on my phone. Only it's not from Ben.
You stupid little bitch. Think you can get away with what you've done?
Shit. I swallow past the sudden dryness in my throat. Then I delete it. Block the number. As I say, it was all a bit last minute coming here. Ben didn't sound that thrilled when I called him earlier and told him I was on my way. True, I didn't give him much time to get used to the idea. But then it's always felt like the bond between us is more important to me than it is to my half-brother. I suggested we hang out last Christmas, but he said he was busy.
Skiing, he said.
Didn't even know he could ski. Sometimes it even feels like I'm an embarrassment to him. I represent the past, and he'd rather be cut loose from all that. I had to explain I was desperate. Hopefully it'll only be for a month or two, and I'll pay my way, I said. Just as soon as I get on my feet. I'll get a job. Yeah. One where they don't ask too many questions. That's how you end up in the places I've worked at. There aren't that many that will take you when your references are such a shit show. Up until this afternoon, I was gainfully employed at the Copacabana Bar in Brighton. The odd massive tip made up for it. A load of wanker bankers, say, down from London celebrating some Dick or Harry or Tobias's upcoming nuptials and too pissed to count the notes outright. Or maybe to guys like that it's just so much loose change anyway. But as of today, I'm unemployed. Again. I press the buzzer a second time. No answer. All the building's windows are dark again, even the one that lit up before. Christ's sake. He couldn't have turned in for the night and totally forgotten about me, Could he? Below all the other buzzers, there's a separate one. Concierge, it reads in curly script. Like something in a hotel. Further proof that this place is seriously upmarket. I press the button. Wait. No answer. But I can't help imagining someone looking at the little video image of me, assessing, then deciding not to open up. I lift up the heavy knocker again and slam it several times against the wood. The sound echoes down the street. Someone must hear it. I can just make out a dog barking from somewhere deep inside the building. I wait 5 minutes. No one comes. Shit. I can't afford a hotel. I don't have enough for a return journey to London. And even if I did, there's no way I'm going back. I consider my options. Go to a bar? Wait it out? I hear footsteps behind me, ringing out on the cobblestones. Ben? I spin round, ready for him to apologise, tell me he just popped out to get some ciggies or something. But the figure walking towards me isn't my brother. He's too tall, too broad, a parka hood with a fur rim up over his head. He's moving quickly, and there's something purposeful about his walk. I grip the handle of my suitcase a little tighter. Literally everything I own is in here. He's only a few meters away now. Close enough that, by the light of the street lamp, I can make out the gleam of his eyes under the hood. He's reaching into his pocket, pulling his hand back out. Something makes me take a step backwards. And now I see it. Something sharp and metallic, gleaming in his hand.
Concierge, the lodge. I watch her on the intercom screen, the stranger at the gate. What can she be doing here? She rings the buzzer again. She must be lost. I know just from looking at her that she has no business being here. Except she seems certain that this is the place she wants. So determined. Now she looks into the lens. I will not let her in. I cannot. I am the gatekeeper of this building. Sitting here in my lodge, a tiny cabin in the corner of the courtyard, which would fit maybe 20 times into the apartments above me. But it is mine, at least. My private space. My home. Most people wouldn't consider it worthy of the name. If I sit on the pull-down bed, I can touch nearly all the corners of the room at once. There is damp spreading from the ground and down from the roof, and the windows don't keep out the cold. But there are 4 walls. There is a place for me to put my photographs with their echoes of a life once lived. The little relics I have collected and which I hold on to when I feel most alone. The flowers I pick from the courtyard garden every other morning, so there is something fresh and alive in here. This place, for all its shortcomings, represents security. Without it, I have nothing. I look again at the face on the intercom screen. As the light catches her just so, I see a familiarity. The sharp line of the nose and jaw. But more than her appearance, it is something about the way she moves, looks around her. A hungry, vulpine quality that reminds me of another. All the more reason not to let her in. I don't like strangers. I don't like change. Change has always been dangerous for me. He proved that, coming here with his questions, his charm. the man who came to live in the third floor apartment, Benjamin Daniels. After he came here, everything changed.
Jess. He's coming straight for me. The guy in the parka. He's lifting his arm. The metal of the blade gleams again. Shit. I'm about to turn and run. Get a few yards on him at least. But wait. No. No. I can see now that the thing in his hand isn't a blade. It's an iPhone. In a metallic case. I let out the breath I've been holding and lean against my bag, hit by a sudden wave of tiredness. I've been wired all day. No wonder I'm spooking at shadows. I watch as the guy makes a call. I can make out a tinny little voice at the other end. A woman's voice, I think. Then he begins to talk, over her, louder and louder, until he's shouting into his handset. I have no idea what the words mean exactly, but I don't need to know much French to understand this isn't a polite or friendly chat. After he's got his long, angry speech off his chest, he hangs up and shoves the phone back in his pocket. Then he spits out a single word.
Putain.
I know that one. I got a D in my French GCSE, but I did look up all the swear words once, and I'm good at remembering the stuff that interests me. Whore. That's what it means. Now he turns and starts walking in my direction again, and I see, quite clearly, that he just wants to use the gate to this building. I step aside, feeling a total idiot for having got so keyed up over nothing. But it makes sense. I spent the whole Eurostar journey looking over my shoulder. You know, just in case. Bonsoir, I say in my best accent, flashing my most winning smile. Maybe this guy will let me in, and I can go up to the third floor and hammer on Ben's apartment door. Maybe his buzzer's simply not working or something. The guy doesn't reply. He just turns to the keypad next to the gate and punches in a series of numbers. Finally, he gives me a quick glance over his shoulder. It's not the most friendly glance. I catch a waft of booze, stale and sour. Same breath as most of the punters in the Copacabana. I smile again.
Excusez-moi. Please, I need some help. I'm looking for my brother, Ben, Benjamin Daniels.
I wish I had a bit more of Ben's flair, his charm.
Benjamin Silvertongue, Mum called him.
He's always had this way of getting anyone to do what he wants. Maybe that's why he ended up a journalist in Paris, while I've been working for a bloke affectionately known as the pervert, in a shithole bar in Brighton serving stag doos at the weekends and local lowlifes in the week. The guy turns back to face me, slowly.
Benjamin Daniels, he says.
Not a question, just the name, repeated. I see something. Anger. Maybe fear. He knows who I'm talking about.
Benjamin Daniels is not here.
What do you mean, he's not here? I ask. This is the address he gave me. He's up on the third floor. I can't get hold of him. The man turns his back on me. I watch as he pulls open the gate. Finally, he turns round to face me a third time, and I think, maybe he is going to help me, after all. Then, in accented English, very slowly and loudly, he says,
Fuck off,
little girl.
Before I even have time to reply, there's a clang of metal and I jump backwards. He slammed the gate shut, right in my face. As the ringing fades from my ears, I'm left with just the sound of my breathing, fast and loud. But he's helped me, even though he doesn't know it. I wait a moment, take a quick look back down the street. Then I lift my hand to the keypad and punch in the same numbers I watched him use only a few seconds ago. 7561. Bingo. The little light flickers green and I hear the mechanism of the gate click open. Dragging my case after me, I slip inside.
Mimi, fourth floor. Merde! I just heard his name, out there, in the night. I lift my head, listening. For some reason, I'm on top of the covers, not under them. My hair feels damp, the pillow cold and soggy. I shiver. Am I hearing things? Did I imagine it? His name. Following me everywhere? No. I'm sure it was real. A woman's voice, drifting up through the open window of my bedroom. Somehow I heard it 4 stories up. Somehow I heard it through the roar of white noise inside my head. Who is she? Why is she asking about him? I sit up, pulling my bony knees tight against my chest, and reach for my childhood doudou, Monsieur Goose, a scraggy old penguin toy I still keep beside my pillow. I press him against my face, try to comfort myself with the feel of his hard little head, the soft, shifting scrunch of the beans inside his body, the musty smell of him. Just like I did as a little girl when I'd had a bad dream.
You're not a little girl any longer, Mimi.
He said that. Ben. The moon is so bright that my whole room is filled with a cold blue light. Nearly a full moon. In the corner, I can make out my record player, the case of vinyls next to it. I painted the walls in here such a dark blackish blue that they don't reflect any light at all. But the poster hanging opposite me seems to glow. It's a Cindy Sherman. I went to her show at the Pompidou last year. I got completely obsessed with how raw and freaky and intense her work is. The kind of thing I try to do with my painting. In the poster, one of the untitled film stills, she's wearing a short black wig, and she stares out at you like she's possessed, or like she might be about to eat your soul. Putain! My flatmate Camille laughed when she saw it. What happens if you bring some guy back? He's gonna have to look at that angry bitch while you're screwing? That'll put him off his rhythm. As if, I thought at the time. 19 years old and still a virgin. Worse, a convent school educated virgin. I stare at Cindy, the black bruise-like shadows around her eyes, the jagged line of her hair which is kind of like my own since I took a pair of scissors to it. It feels like looking in a mirror. I turn to the window, look down into the courtyard. The lights are on in the concierge's cabin. Of course, that nosy old bitch never misses a trick. Creeping out from shadowy corners, always watching, always there. Looking at you like she knows all your secrets. This building is a U-shape around the courtyard. My bedroom is at one end of the U. So, if I peer diagonally downwards, I can see into his apartment. Nearly every evening for the last 2 months, he sat there at his desk working late into the night, the lights on. For just a moment, I let myself look. The shutters are open, but the lights are off. and the space behind the desk looks more than empty, or like the emptiness itself has a kind of depth and weight. I glance away. I slide down from my bed and tiptoe out into the main part of the apartment, trying not to trip over all the stuff Camille leaves scattered around like it's an extension of her bedroom. Magazines and dropped sweaters, dirty coffee cups, nail varnish pots, lacy bras. From the big windows in here, I've got a direct view of the front entrance. As I watch, the gate opens. A shadowy figure slips through the gap. As she comes forward into the light, I can make her out. A woman I have never seen before. No, I say silently. No, 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 no. Go away. The roar in my head grows louder. Did you hear that knocking? I spin around. Putain! Camille's lounging there on the couch, cigarette glowing in her hand, boots up on the armrest, faux snakeskin with 5-inch heels. When did she get in? How long has she been lurking there in the dark? I thought you were out, I say. Normally, if she goes clubbing, she stays till dawn. Oui. She shrugs, takes a drag on her cigarette. I've only been back 20 minutes. Even in the gloom, I see how her eyes slide away from mine. Normally, she'd be straight into some story about the crazy new club she's been at, or the guy whose bed she's just left, including an overly detailed description of his dick, or exactly how skilled he was at using it. I've often felt like I'm living vicariously through Camille. Grateful someone like her would choose to hang out with me. When we met at the Sorbonne, she told me she likes collecting people, that I interested her because I have this intense energy. But when I felt worse about myself, I've suspected this apartment probably has more to do with it. Where have you been? I ask, trying to sound halfway normal. She shrugs. Just around. I feel like there's something going on with her. Something she's not telling me. But right now, I can't think about Camille. The roaring in my head suddenly feels like it's drowning out all my thoughts. There's just one thing I know. Everything that has happened here happened because of him. Benjamin Daniels.
Jess. I'm standing in a small, dark courtyard. The apartment building proper wraps around it on three sides. The ivy has gone crazy here, winding up almost to the fourth floor, surrounding all the windows, swallowing drain pipes, a couple of satellite dishes. Ahead, a short path winds between flower beds planted with dark shrubs and trees. I can smell the sweetish scent of dead leaves, fresh-turned earth. To my right, there's a sort of cabin structure, only a bit bigger than a garden shed. The two windows seem to be shuttered. On one side, a tiny chink of light shows through a crack. In the opposite corner, I make out a door, which seems to lead into the main part of the building. I head that way along the path. As I do, a pale face looms suddenly out of the darkness on my right. I stop short. But it's the statue of a nude woman, life-size, her body wound about with more black ivy, her eyes staring and blank. The door in the corner of the courtyard has another passcode, but it clicks open with the same set of numbers, thank God. I step through it into a dark, echoing space. A stairwell winds upwards into deeper darkness. I find the little orange glow of a light switch on the wall. Flick it. The lights hum on, dimly. A ticking sound, some sort of energy-saving timer, maybe. I can see now that there's a dark reddish carpet beneath my feet, covering a stone floor, then climbing up the polished wooden staircase. Above me, the banister coils around on itself, and inside the staircase there's a lift shaft, a tiny rickety-looking capsule that might be as old as the building itself. So ancient-looking, I wonder if it's actually still in use. There's a trace of stale cigarette smoke on the air. Still, all pretty posh. All a long, long way from the place I've been crashing at in Brighton. There's a door to the left of me. Cave, it says. I've never let a closed door stay closed for long. I suppose you could say that's my main problem in life. I give it a push. See a flight of steps leading down. I'm hit by a waft of cold underground air, damp and musty. I hear a noise then, somewhere above me, the creak of wood. I let the door swing shut and glance up. Something moves along the wall several flights up. I wait to see someone appear around the corner, in the gaps between the banisters. But the shadow stops, as though waiting for something. And then suddenly, everything goes dark. The timer must have run out. I reach over, flick it back on. The shadow's gone. I walk over to the lift in its metal cage. It's definitely on the antique side, but I'm too exhausted to even think about lugging my stuff up those stairs. There's barely room for me and the suitcase inside. I close the little door, press the button for the third floor, put a hand against the structure to steady myself. It gives under the pressure of my palm. I hastily pull my hand away. There's a bit of a shudder as the lift sets off. I catch my breath. Up I go. Each floor has one door, marked with a brass number. Is that only one apartment per floor? They must be pretty big. I imagine the sleeping presence of strangers behind those doors. I wonder who lives in them, what Ben's neighbours are like. And I find myself wondering which apartment the dickhead I met at the gate lives in. The lift judders to a halt on the third floor. I step out onto the landing and drag my suitcase after me. Here it is, Ben's apartment, with its brass number 3. I give it a couple of loud knocks. No answer. I crouch down and look at the keyhole. It's the old-fashioned kind, easiest in the world to pick. Needs must. I take out my hoop earrings and bend them out of shape. The convenience of cheap jewellery. Leaving me with two long, thin pieces of metal. I make my rake and my pick. Ben actually taught me this when we were little, so he can hardly complain. I got so good at it, I can unpick a simple pin tumbler mechanism in less than a minute. I wiggle the earrings back and forth in the lock until there's a click, then turn the handle. Yes, the door begins to open. A pause. Something about this doesn't feel right. I've had to rely on my instincts quite a lot over the years. And I've also been here before, hand clasped around the door handle, not knowing what I'm going to find on the other side. Deep breath. For a moment it feels like the air contracts around me. I find myself gripping the pendant of my necklace. It's a St. Christopher. Mum gave us both one, to keep us safe. Even if that was her job, not something to be outsourced to a little metal saint. I'm not religious, and I'm not sure Mum was either. All the same, I can't imagine ever being parted from mine. With my other hand, I push the handle down. I can't stop myself from squeezing my eyes tight shut as
as I step into the space. It's pitch black inside.
Ben?
I call out. No answer. I step further inside, grope about for a light switch. As the lights come on, the apartment reveals itself. My first thought is, Christ, it's huge. Bigger even than I expected. Grander. High-ceilinged. Dark wooden beams up above, polished floorboards below. Huge windows facing down onto the courtyard. I take another step into the room. As I do, something lands across my shoulders. A blunt, heavy blow. Then the sting of something sharp, tearing into my flesh.
Concierge, the lodge. A few minutes after the knocking, I watched through the windows of my lodge as the first figure entered the courtyard, his hood pulled up. Then I saw a second figure appear. The newcomer, the girl, clattering that huge suitcase across the cobbles of the courtyard, making enough noise to wake the dead. I watched her on the intercom screen until the buzzer stopped ringing. I am good at watching. I sweep the residence hallways. I collect their post. I answer the door. But also, I watch. I see everything. And it gives me a strange kind of power, even if I'm the only one who's aware of it. The residents forget about me. It's convenient for them to do so, to imagine that I'm nothing more than an extension of this building, just a moving element of a large machine, like the lift that takes them up to their beautiful apartments. In a way, I have become part of this place. It has certainly left its mark on me. I am sure the years of living in this tiny cabin have caused me to shrink, hunching into myself, while the hours spent sweeping and scrubbing the corridors and stairs of the apartment building have winnowed my flesh. Perhaps in another life I would have grown plump in my old age. I have not had that luxury. I am sinew and bone. Stronger than I look. I suppose I could have gone and stopped her. Should have done. But confrontation is not my style. I have learned that watching is the more powerful weapon. And it had a feeling of inevitability, her being here. I could see her determination. She would somehow have found her way in, no matter what I did to try and prevent her. Stupid girl. It would have been far, far better if she turned and left this place and never returned. But it's too late now. So be it.
Jess. My heart is beating double time. My muscles tensed. I look down at the cat as it weaves its way between my legs, purring. A blur of movement. Slinky, black, a white ruff. I put a hand down the back of my top. My fingers come away with a sheen of blood. Ouch! The cat must have jumped onto my back from the counter next to the door, digging its claws in for grip when I fell forward. It looks up at me now, through narrowed green eyes, and gives a squawk, as though asking me what the hell I think I'm doing here. A cat. Jesus Christ. I start laughing, and then stop, quickly, because of the strange way the sound echoes around the high space. I didn't know Ben had a cat. Does he even like cats? It suddenly seems crazy that I don't know this. But I suppose there's not all that much I do know about his life here.
Ben?
I call out.
Again, the sound of my voice bounces back at me. No answer. I don't think I expected one. It feels too silent, too empty. There's a strange smell, too. Something chemical. I suddenly really need a drink. I wander into the little kitchen area to my right and start raiding the cupboards. First things first. I come up with half a bottle of red wine. I'd prefer something with more of a kick, but beggars can't be choosers, and that might as well be the motto for my whole bloody life. I slosh some into a glass. There's a pack of fags on the side too. A bright blue box. Gitanes. I didn't know Ben still smoked. Typical of him to favour some fancy French brand. I fish one out, light up, inhale and cough like I did the first time a fellow foster kid gave me a drag. It's strong, spicy, unfiltered. I'm not sure I like it. Still, I push the rest of the pack into the back pocket of my jeans. He owes me. And take my first proper look around the place. I'm surprised, to say the least. I'm not sure what I imagined, but this isn't it. Ben's a bit creative, a bit cool. Not that I'd ever describe him that way to his face. And in contrast, this whole apartment is covered in antique-looking old lady wallpaper, silvery with a floral pattern. When I put out a hand and touch the nearest wall, I realise it's not paper after all. It's a very faded silk. I see brighter spots where there were clearly once pictures hanging, small rusty age spots on the fabric. From the high ceiling hangs a chandelier, curls of metal holding the bulbs. A long strand of cobwebs swings lazily back and forth. There must be a breeze coming from somewhere. And maybe there were once curtains behind those window shutters. I see an empty curtain rail up above, the brass rings still in place. A desk plumb in front of the windows. A shelf holding a few ivory-coloured books. A big navy French dictionary. In the near corner, there's a coat stand with an old khaki jacket on it. I'm sure I've seen Ben wearing it before. Maybe even the last time I saw him, about a year ago, when he came down to Brighton and bought me lunch before disappearing back out of my life again without a backward glance. I reach into the pockets and draw out a set of keys and a brown leather wallet. Is it a bit strange that Ben's gone but left these behind? I open the wallet. The back pocket's stuffed with a few euro notes. I take a 20 and then, for good measure, a couple of tens. I'd have asked to borrow some money if he was here anyway. I'll pay it back. Sometime. A business card is stuffed into the front of the section that holds credit cards. It reads, Theo Mendelssohn, Paris editor, Guardian. And scribbled on it in biro, in what looks like Ben's handwriting. Sometimes he remembers to send me a birthday card. Pitch story to him. I look at the keys next. One of them's for a Vespa, which is odd as last time I saw him, he was driving an old 80s Mercedes soft top. The other's a large antique-looking thing that looks like it might be for this place. I go to the door and try it. The lock clicks. The uneasy feeling in the pit of my stomach grows. But he might have another set of keys. These could be spares, the set he's going to lend me. He probably has another key for the Vespa, too. He might even have gone off on it somewhere. As for the wallet, he's probably just carrying cash. I find the bathroom next. Nothing much to report here. other than the fact that Ben doesn't appear to own any towels at all, which seems bizarre. I step back out into the main room. The bedroom must be through the closed pair of French double doors. I walk towards them, the cat following, pressing close as a shadow. Just for a moment, I hesitate. The cat squawks at me again, as if to ask, "What are you waiting for?" I take another long slug of wine. Deep breath. Push open the doors. Another breath. Open my eyes. Empty bed. Empty room. No one here. Breathe out. Okay. I mean, I didn't really think I was going to find anything like that. That's not Ben. Ben's sorted. I'm the fuck up. But when it's happened to you once. I drain the dregs from my glass, then go through the cupboards in the bedroom. Not much by way of clues, except that most of my brother's clothes seem to come from places called Acne. Why would you wear clothes named after a skin condition? An APC. Back out in the main room, I pour the remainder of the bottle into the glass and neck it back. Drift over to the desk by the large windows, which look down onto the courtyard. There's nothing on the desk beyond a ratty-looking biro. No laptop. Ben seemed surgically attached to it when he took me for lunch that time, getting it out and typing something while we waited for our order. I suppose he must have it with him, wherever he is. All at once, I have the definite feeling that I'm not alone, that I'm being watched. A prickle down the back of my neck. I spin around. No one there except the cat, which is sitting on the kitchen counter. Perhaps that's all it was. The cat gazes at me for a few moments, then turns its head on one side like it's asking a question. It's the first time I've seen it sit still like this. Then it raises a paw to its mouth and licks. This is when I notice that both the paw and the white ruff at its throat are smeared with blood. Jess. I've gone cold. What the? I reach out to the cat to try and get a closer look, but it slinks out from under my hand. Maybe it's just caught a mouse or something. One of the families I fostered with had a cat, Suki. Even though she was small, she could take down a whole pigeon. She came back once covered in blood like something out of a horror film, and my foster parent Karen found the headless body later that morning. I'm sure there's some small dead creature lying around the apartment, just waiting for me to step on it. Or maybe it killed something out there in the courtyard. Windows are open a crack, which must be how it gets in and out of this place. Walking along the guttering or something. Still, it gave me a bit of a jolt. When I saw it for a moment, I thought, no. I'm just tired. I should try and get some sleep. Ben will turn up in the morning, explain where he's been. I'll tell him he's a dick for leaving me to basically break in, and it'll be like old times, the old, old times, before he went to live with his shiny, rich new family and got a whole new way of speaking and perspective on the world. And I got bounced around the care system until I was old enough to fend for myself. I'm sure he's fine. Bad stuff doesn't happen to Ben. He's the lucky one. I shrug off my jacket, throw it onto the sofa. I should probably take a shower. I'm pretty sure I stink. A bit of BO, but mainly of vinegar. You can't work at the Copacabana and not reek of the stuff. It's what we use to sluice the bar down after every shift. I'm too tired to wash. I think Ben might have mentioned something about a camp bed, but I don't see any sign of one. So I take a throw from the sofa and lie down in the bedroom on top of the covers and all my clothes. I give the pillows some thumps to try and rearrange them. As I do, something slithers out of the bed onto the floor. A pair of women's knickers. Black silk. Lacy. Expensive looking. Ew. Christ, Ben. I don't want to think about how those got here. I don't even know if Ben has a girlfriend. I feel a little pang of sadness, in spite of myself. He's all I've got, and I don't even know this much about him. I'm too tired to do much more than kick the knickers away, out of sight. Tomorrow, I'll sleep on the sofa.